You're listening to Star Wars Beyond the Films, the official expanded universe podcast of StarWarsReport.com.
There is a great disturbance in the Force.
Welcome to episode 33 of Star Wars Beyond the Films, your Star Wars discussion podcast. That's right, Whistler. We broadcast on Middle Earth Network Radio as well as on the Star Wars Report website. Our episodes are also available on our own Facebook page at SW Beyond Films. But enough about how you got here to our show. Let's get it started. I'm one of your hosts, the defender of the EU, Mark Herleman. And with me, like the Gloid to my Yaru Corson, the EU guru himself, Nathan P. Butler!
That's right, homies. I'm a big creepy alien and I got a suicide bomber thing going on, so you better not mess with me. Better not step.
Kamikaze!
Exactly.
I actually liked Gloid, and I liked, what was it, Ravelin? Was that how you say his name?
Yeah, Ravelin or Rivelin or Riddlin. I
don't know. Something about the alien characters from the first part of the book I really dug. You know, things might sound a little different from my end. I am currently at the old Echo Base. You know, I've got the portable studio going on. Studio in a box. The new place that I'm at has got a manufactured home feel to it, and they've got these little vents everywhere, so I'm not quite 100% sure if the sound quality there is going to be up to par, and I didn't want to risk it. So I'm going to get with Riley at some point. We're going to do some audio tests, and hopefully next time I'll be at the new place. Won't be back and forth between the old one and the new one, but we're here. We're chugging along, still plugging and filling your airways with some Star Wars EU goodness. That's right. Nathan, what do we got today?
Well, as we always say here at Star Wars Beyond the Films, we ask the tough questions, questions that have bothered you for a long time, simple ones that have perplexed you off and on. You ponder about Star Wars, and of course, so do we. This episode, we are going to continue our three-part look at John Jackson Miller's Lost Tribe of the Sith series, originally released as ebooks for books 1 through 8, and recently collected in paperback with a final ninth story as Lost Tribe of the Sith, The Collected Stories. This time, we're covering books 5 through 8, which are Purgatory, Sentinel, Pantheon, and Secrets. Consider this your spoiler warning because here we go.
I'm really enjoying this book, and as we've been doing this, I've been rereading. I got into Sentinel, and that was where I jumped off with the free ebooks. I stopped right there when I found out what was going on with Jelf. I was like, you know, maybe I don't want to continue this, because I think that was about the same point they told us we were going to get in a paperback down the road. So I was like, well, I'll wait from here on out so everything is new for me. And it's definitely been that. In the last episode, I mentioned how we had a 16 chapters, and then followed up with Pantheon 16 chapters. I was wrong. Secrets actually had 5 chapters to it. So it was 16, 17, 16. It's not that bad. I mean, it was really only like a page and a half. You could have tied them together, but for story's sake, they made an extra chapter. But when we get to the end of this, you know, I mentioned before in the last episode about how they had the map in the front and how much I like the maps, and I think that's a great idea. By the time we get done with this set of stories, we will have another map, which we will also cover again when we get to Pandemonium. It's very key to that. And I originally questioned why they put it there. I was like, ooh, they should have put it at the front. But the more I think about it, the more I like, actually, that they put it where they did. Because story's sake, that map, as far as you know it, you don't discover anything about it until you get to Secrets. And I like the fact that they kept that map a secret until you got to the end and you flip the page and you're like, ooh, another map. And so in that regard, I thought that was a very clever move on Del Rey's part. You know, I'm really digging the maps. Del Rey, if you're listening to our show, I really hope you find ways to add more maps, whether they be on the planets or galactic maps. The maps, I don't know, there's a Tolkien feel to it. You know, there's some added depth of history to it. I really get a kick out of being able to look on a map and see the places that they're talking about and understand where that fits in conjunction with other things. You know, if I ever get to interview John Jackson Miller, I really want to find out what, when he envisions Kesh, what it looked like. Did it look like Hawaii? Did it look like, were there certain areas like Arizona? You know, were there places here in our world that he was thinking of when he was drawing these things? Like, was it Scotland and Ireland with the Highlands? I mean, there's so many things that I would love to just tickle and pick at this man's brain and figure out all the in-depth stuff.
You know, if it's a land ruled by Sith, wouldn't it have to be Washington, D.C.? Anyway, just talking about politics is so freaking corrupt in general. But no, I think you have a good point there about just this idea of the way this book is organized is kind of interesting, having that second map show up, but not show up until we even know that there is a second continent on the planet of Kesh. For those who are new to the series, the idea is that when they crash, they think that the land that they are on is all that there is. Only Yaru Korsin knew better from scans from the Omen that there was a larger continent out there, whether it's a Keshta Major, since the other one was Keshta Minor, they would just call it Keshta, or as the natives call Keshta Major, they call it Alanciar. But they didn't want to give that away. You might at first say, wait a second, why are they giving us a map and naming this continent if they weren't going to also have another continent the first time you see the first map? But I think that's sort of a question that, if it pops up in your mind, would have faded away by the time you've read 8 different little ebook stories, and then you finally get to the point where it's revealed, yes, there is another continent out there, and then here it is with Alanciar. Speaking of organization, I do have to say one thing I feel is sort of missing from this book is it would have been nice to have, even if it was just in black and white, or maybe just, you know, on the back cover somewhere, it would have been kind of nice to see those images from the covers of the ebooks again, because they were really nice, and it was a cool theme where they all had sort of the Sith face up at the top and then something cool down at the bottom that somehow was a landscape that tied into the story.
When you mentioned that, they used to have that in the books where you would open up certain books and the covers would be there. I mean, I think Fate of the Jedi and Legacy of the Force even had that, where right before you got to the timeline, there would be pictures of like the first 4 or 5 books.
Yeah, I think it was like a solicitation page or essentially like an advertisement page. This one doesn't have anything like that. Not that that's necessarily a bad thing. It's not necessary, but it would have been kind of neat because I do like the thematic way they've done the covers, including this one. They also make it a point, and this is very important, I think, in the grand scheme of things for this series, since it does jump time periods, to always make sure, both in the ebook form and in the printed form here, to give us the dates. They will tell us the dates of the story. It's not all done by context clues, with the exception of one tiny piece of one of the stories covered in this part. We started out last time with Precipice and Skyborn kind of interweaving with each other and interweaving with Cross Current and interweaving with the Fall of the Sith Empire and Golden Age of the Sith comics from Tales of the Jedi around 5,000 BBY. Then we jumped ahead 15 years. We got Paragon in 4,985 BBY. Then we jumped one last time in what we covered last episode to get Savior, 4,975 BBY. And that was essentially the Korsin family story. And then we cut it there, and in a sense, the storyline cuts it there because then it jumps. Now we're dealing with 2 different eras this time. Rather than having essentially a 25-year time period for 4 different stories like we had last time, this time we have 2 different pairs of stories, each of which span basically a year or only a tiny bit beyond a year. Purgatory and Sentinel essentially form one story in this case. Purgatory and Sentinel take place predominantly in the year 3960 BBY. We know this because, number one, they say it in Purgatory. We also have the reference to the fact that Jelf, the Jedi in the story, who's been essentially stuck on Kesh at least for a little while, this Jedi was a member of the Jedi Covenant, tying it back into the Knights of the Old Republic comics.
Yeah, that was a nice twist.
Yeah, and they've now fallen, so they're gone. So 3960 makes sense there. The one tweak to that, I would say, is not to forget that Sentinel gets to a point where it jumps. I want to say it's like 8 weeks or something in the middle of the story. And by the time it's jumped that 8 weeks, Revan is now back in the Republic. So it has to move into 3,959 BBY. It has to move into that next year at least a little bit. Otherwise, Revan would not have been back yet. So even though it's listed as spanning 1 year, technically expands a year and a tiny bit. Sentinel picks up the day after Purgatory, but then there's that 8-week jump that crosses a year line somewhere. Then
we've I wouldn't have caught that. That whole jump there would have been missed by me. I caught the references to Lucian Dre, the everything that was going on with Revan, the Covenant. I thought that was really cool. Nice little tie-in. Kind of, in a sense, even ties into Vector, since that I believe Vector was when we really started learning a lot of depth about what was going on with the Covenant, what the Covenant stood for, what the Jedi Shadows were doing, and all that kind of stuff. And I liked how it was a subtle reference to it. You know, you mentioned how the first two chapters jump in and of itself. I was kind of bummed by that because I was really kind of expecting, like I said, I stopped reading It Sentinel. I don't even think I finished it. I found out that Jeff was part of the Jedi, and I was just like, whoa, backing off, because I was like, where are we going with this? And I was really excited, and then find out that it ended right there and that their story never got referenced really again. I think like the closest we get to a reference to this is the Night of the Upside Down Meteor. And I'm like, really? That's it? I want more.
Yeah, well, the only reason I realized it was I was in the process of summarizing it for the Star Wars Timeline Gold, which, by the way, folks, there's a new edition of the Star Wars Timeline Gold out there. I think I said Gold. Star Wars Timeline Gold, there you go, out there as of August 7th. So it's the 50th edition. It's just about 2,200 pages. It's over that if you count the covers. It's one page shy of it if you don't count the covers. And there's a new Star Wars EU Primer edition of that podcast. You can find it at StarWarsFanWars.com. It'll eventually be here through our Beyond the Films feed as well, and on StarWarsReport.com. That's that five-part primer for the saga as a whole. But as I was working on that, as I was summarizing this, I was like, okay, well, this is no big deal. And then here I am scrolling down to the next year just to double-check, and oh, that's when Revan is known to have come back into the Republic. So there had to have been a jump there. And they had this eight-week gap, which meant that 8-week gap had to be where the year transition was, which also told me that the beginning of Sentinel and Purgatory before it, since there's only a day difference, would have to have been late in the preceding year. I mean, that's the kind of logic we have to go through when we're doing anything with chronology, because it all has to somehow fit, hopefully. But then it jumps one more time, at least from what we're seeing here. It'll jump again for Pandemonium. But it jumps one more time and goes from this first two-story set of Purgatory and Sentinel, 3,960 BBY, up to just a nice round number of 3,000 BBY, an era in which there's not a whole lot of other stories that we've seen for Pantheon and Secrets. So it's almost like, I mean, we were saying last time that it's almost like you could say it's sort of like three different stories. You've got the first four, the next four, and then Pandemonium. I think we probably ought to narrow that down even more and say it's almost like there's four stories. The first four, and then five and six, and then seven and eight, and then nine. Because in a sense, there's not a lot of connection here between Purgatory and Sentinel and Pantheon and Secrets, which is when I started to lose a little bit of interest. I think I said last episode how the first four were really, really good, but it did seem like there were some points where it slowed down and it wasn't quite as gripping as we went along, and that it would come up in these four. This is when it happens. I mean, Purgatory and Sentinel, good. Pantheon and Secrets, good. Compare either of those two pairs to the first four books, and there's no comparison whatsoever. I mean, they enter in, it's a different mood, it's a different group of characters. There's no one as gripping as the Coruscant family, in my opinion, in those next couple of pairs that we're covering this time around. Ori is cool. Jelf the Jedi was an unexpected character. Lilia Vin, the Grand Lord, who winds up getting blown up because she tries to steal the Orex Starfighter, and it has basically a back away from the car, kaboom, kind of thing. And then Varner Hiltz, right? And Ileana Mirko, later Ileana Hiltz. You know, they're interesting, and I kind of like the idea of a historian turning out to be a Grand Lord because I'm a history teacher. But at the same time, interesting as they were, they couldn't hold a candle to the interest that I had in the Coruscant family.
Huh. See, that's funny because I'm kind of opposite. I mean, I agree with you that I think that Sentinel and Purgatory fit like a separate story, but I liked how these four worked in the aspect of telling the missing story in the middle. I mean, granted, you might be able to say we could have done without Purgatory and Sentinel, and that could have all been told from Hilt's point of view of the history side. That could have worked. But I liked what we got in Purgatory and Sentinel. Jelf's character was crazy. I mean, when he pulls out the fact that he's not only had the ship, he's also got the communications device, but there's something on the planet that causes them not to be able to get out. You know, we get little touches like this. Ori's character, you know, it gives you the background of what's going on with the Sith back plotting and this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, stuff that we got in the first ones, but now it's more like, you know, this has been an established government kind of thing. This is how they do it. But when Jelf gets to the stuff where he's talking about Revan, and he goes, this is our fault. He's talking about the now civil war that the Jedi are having. And she goes, the Jedi sect you belong to? Yes, he looked up at the twilight, unable to find any evening stars through the foliage. And that's the trouble. There aren't supposed to be any Jedi sects. The Order is divided now, but we divided it first. He shook his head. May the Force help them all. And from her perspective, you know, she's like looking at the galaxy out there full of Jedi. And now he's looking at it like, you know, the civil war. And so at the end of their story, they decide, you know, we're just going to go and do our own thing. I mean, I at this point have just started Pandemonium. I don't know if they're ever going to come back to that, and I hope they do, because I really want to know what happened to them, their line. I mean, you know, there is that constant complaint inside fandom about fans like me that want to connect the dots with everything. And in this case, I really want to know. I want to know what the product of a Sith Jedi relationship is, where they both decide to turn their back on everything they knew and start something new. You know, that's been a thought of mine for a long time, is where will this go? By the time we get to Pantheon and we start learning about the stuff with Hilts and how everything has gone topsy-turvy because of the events in Sentinel and with the Grand Lord Ven's sudden, miraculously curse-like death. And I love how they kind of tied it in with the curse of what happened at the Ragnos Lakes and the abandoned cities there, and the fact that we learn that the cities from the first four books that were poisoned, you know, they're completely abandoned still to this day. I thought that was an interesting little twist too, and that the culture kind of got this taboo about it and stuff. But Ori's character was the daughter of a Grand Lord that was set to take her place, and you know, her whole purpose to going out and seeing Jelf was to get these special flowers that he made. And he'd go up into the jungles and stuff where no one would go, and he'd get certain materials, and he would say it was because the nutrients were better up there. But secretly, he had that listening device, and he would go up there and he would listen to what was being recorded. And that was when he learned about what was going on with Revan and everything. And the way that all that played out, I found that there was an added bit of isolation to the tribe in Jelf's backstory. And I love the way that he would tell the truth without telling the truth. Like, she said something about, well, you're Sith too. And he's like, that's what they tell me. And I'm just like, yes, that's classic. I mean, he was like always being honest and yet hiding it all. And we find out that in the Uvik pen, where all the Uvik dung goes and the manure, is where he's got the ship buried. And then when it all plays out, I really was enjoying all that, so much so that when that ended and we jumped forward again, I was really bummed. I'm really kind of hoping that somehow, some way, we'll get a tie back to that. I doubt it, but, you know, like what we had happen with Adari. When Adari's story in the first set of books, the last we saw her, she was flying off with all those Uvoks, and they go out in the middle of the ocean, and they find a little tiny island mass, and, it, you know, it's like, well, where are they going to be? Obviously, they, at some point, get to the new Kreshta Major, but from what we learned later in Secrets, that hadn't happened yet. Kreshta Major already had population. So I'm really looking forward to where that story is going to go in Pandemonium, just from what we've gotten from the first eight books. You know, it really set up a lot of stuff going on there where, you know, it almost seems spelled out, but then when you stop and think about it, it's like, well, no, you know, Adari can't be the first ones on that planet, because if Yaru saw lights on that side before they even crashed and even met her, well, she couldn't have been there yet. So, ooh, you know, I'm really looking forward to where this is going. And the Hilt story arc of how he kind of, in a sense, resets the tribe during the time of rot, I just liked how all that played out. You know, you had the historian side. We read these books. That's our history. That's our window into the history of the Star Wars universe. But here we've got Hilt, and he's able to put it into perspective for you, where you're able to not only see the aspect of the history being collected, but you're also able to see what the Lost Tribe has degenerated to, you know, where they've forgotten about so much stuff. You know, Nathan, in the first episode of this, you kept talking about the U shape of the technology. Their culture as a whole did the same exact thing. And Hilt's story, like, I was sitting there and I'm like, Hilt, so I'm like, wasn't it in Fate of the Jedi that we heard about a Grand Lord Hilts, you know, and I kept scratching my head. I'm like, I swore I heard about a Grand Lord, you know. And so I kind of had a feeling like he was going to become the Grand Lord by the time it was over. But the way it worked and the fact that the Sith tribe themselves and their infighting, in a sense, forced him to take that role because they destroyed all the information. He was the living relic by the time it was done because they destroyed his library. So it's like, yeah, I've got all the information you need. And then it was like, you know, it became obvious to, and I can't remember what his name is off the top of my head, but the one guy from the Golden Tribe, you know, he drops down and realizes right away what's going on. Adele, that guy, he was the first one to recognize it. He was the first one to drop down and kneel, and then they all pretty much recognize that, you know, this guy is going to be the one that leads us on. And the way that that played out was very interesting to me. I mean, it got me really excited for where we were going to go in Pandemonium. I mean, I'm just like, ooh, they're going to build some ships. We're going to see where this is going. And, you know, really quickly from what I have started of Pandemonium, that starts out from the Kreshta Major point of view. And it's like they have a feeling that they're going to come. And I think that that is a tribute to Adari showing up because obviously she warned them all about what was going to happen. So they've been preparing. I'm really looking forward to where this is going to go because, you know, in Pantheon and Secrets, we learn that they're going to come, they're going to conquer because the Sith need a mission. Otherwise, they're going to just kill each other. The infighting will always work. Darth Bane figured that out long ago. Yaru Corson did as well. And the way that Secrets played out and the way Hilts kept doing it was like an Indiana Jones adventure, you know? It's like he'd go and he'd do something and then it wouldn't quite work. And then it was like, oh man, this is almost like watching National Treasure.
Like I say, you know, taking these two storylines and the things that I got out of them, I guess, or the things that struck me about them, I'm not sure they were along necessarily the same lines. One was when it comes, I guess, out of, I guess, two for each. One, about the first storyline where we had Ori and Jelf. That was an interesting story, but at the same time, enough time had passed, we had all these new groups, all these new factions, and all these new families, the High Lords all jockeying to see who's going to be the next Grand Lord. We have Lilia Venn, who winds up, she eventually winds up getting blown to bits, but for a while there, she's against Ori's family, the Katai family, because they essentially won't pick a side in the jockeying to figure out who is going to be the next Grand Lord when she finally does die, either of old age or something else. It really had that feel of something like, you know, the Game of Thrones. So in this case, when it looks like the Katai family is going to be wiped out, instead their possessions are essentially taken away, they're framed, and one of them winds up cleaning up essentially dung from the different animals. So I guess in this case, in the Game of Thrones, or the Game of Sith Thrones, you win or you shovel crap. But I like that element there of this whole thing with the infighting starting. It really does feel like Game of Thrones. But at the same time, though, we didn't have any background, really, on these particular families. So it almost felt like if you were someone to make that Game of Thrones comparison, you'd be jumping in on the second book or jumping in on the third book. There wasn't enough background necessarily, just because of the length of these stories, to give us a lot to really care about the whole issue with Ben and Katai other than just from the Katai family's point of view. We didn't really see the big picture. It would have been interesting to see that grow, and instead we spent a lot more time with the Ori and Jelf angle, which granted is the bigger picture. The Jedi on the planet, there's a ship they might be able to somehow use to get off of there if they could overcome the same thing that brought down the Omen. But at the same time, when you're first reading it, it feels like it's zipping right along because not a lot of depth is able to be given with so much time being given over to this guy that at first you think, you know, what this farmer, what's his whole thing to do with it? I do like the fact that in a sense, these two stories or these two pairs of stories are connected, just not as much as the last ones were. In this case, the connection is that the Time of Rot starts when Lilia Venn blows up, and after that, you've got this decline that is finally halted by Varner Hilts in the second pair. From the perspective of the second pair, I will say that it is interesting to see not only just the idea that Varner Hilts is able to essentially bring them back together, that he is able to essentially tell them, look, we know who we are now, but we can build something better. We can be something better as we do this, and he's the one with the knowledge to make this happen. The thing that gets me about that is there's almost like a self-respect issue, I guess, in a sense, or a self-perception issue that comes out, a theme that stands out to me, because you start out with this idea, the Sith, the Lost Tribe of the Sith, were effectively slaves of Naga Sadow. And when they were lost, they knew they were slaves of Naga Sadow, at least at first. But they had great pride in who they were, what they were, their ambition to conquer and to always unseat each other for power made them who they were. It made them strong. Now, we have a society who has forgotten that they were slaves. They think of themselves as the rulers, and yet that self-perception hasn't saved them from letting their whole society decline and fall to pieces. Their self-perception, their self-esteem, if you want to call it that, has risen, and yet their station in life and the way they handle their situation has fallen. And it takes learning again that they are slaves and coming to accept that again and say, that doesn't have to be our destiny. Basically, like the original Lost Tribe members said, whenever they were trying to advance, even though they were slaves of Naga Sadow, it takes them coming back to the realization of who they are, what they were, and that they can rise beyond it to make them finally come back together and become strong again. It's essentially the idea that it's not about whether you're a slave or not. Being a slave or not is not defining what your ambitions could be. It's whether you understand who you truly are and are willing to say that what I am now does not define what I can be. I love the themes that are worked out through here. I don't know if these are all themes that John Jackson Miller purposely inserted. We talked about themes last time around. But the themes that wind up rising out of these stories because of the way the story is told brings a lot of these issues back to the fore that I think in Star Wars a lot of times feel like they are lost. A lot of Star Wars stories feel like they're just quick little adventures and they're fun romps, but they don't get a lot of deeper themes added to it. You almost have to compare one book to another and say, the way that this author handled it versus the way this other author handled it, what can we see there literarily that changes the way they look at Star Wars? How do we see a difference? We can compare authors like that. But to look for themes within the text itself is something a lot of times we just can't do. The depth isn't there. In this case, I think it is, and that definitely makes this a worthy read, even for people who haven't read Fate of the Jedi. It is something different from a level of depth that we haven't really seen recently.
Well, and you know, me and you, we've read most of this stuff, so when we see these references, we jump right on it. But if you haven't, you know, you're looking at the grand EU as a place to jump in, and you grab a book like this, and say you're in Sentinel, and Ori and Jelf are talking, and, you know, he whispers, and he's calculating here, the tribe was a remnant from the Great Hyperspace War more than a millennium before. Ori didn't know what had followed. He had a weapon history. There are no more Sith, Jelf said. What? There are no more Sith, he repeated. They're extinct. You're lying, Ori said, wading toward the edge. The vessel you were hiding was a warship. Those big prongs on either side of it. Are you telling me those are for decoration? He shook his head. Yes, we have enemies. And we've even fought Sith in living memory. A Jedi, Ex-Harkoon, fell to the dark side and revived the movement. But they were eradicated, hunted down, all of them. Carefully, he edged his way toward her. As far as I know, your people are the only Sith left alive in the galaxy. And that's one of those things. John Jackson Miller seeds his stories with these little layers of depth that as EU fans like me and Nathan, you know, we really appreciate it. And those of you that are new to it, it gives you these avenues, these doorways to go, I want to know more about this, or I want to know more about that. I remember when I first started reading the Bantham era, you know, these were what I always called open plot lines. And I was always waiting for them to come back to a lot of the open plot lines. And the Bantham era set up a lot of them that they never were able to come back to, whereas Del Rey was able to take those and run with them. I mean, New Jedi Order, we see what happens with Center Point Station. In Fate of the Jedi, what happened in Legacy of the Force with that station, we also get mention of it in Cross Current, where Jaden Kor is thinking about his time on there. You know, little things like that are always the things that jump out to me. I really get a kick out of those kind of things. They're the parts of the story that I really enjoy the most.
I will say, though, he had to be kind of careful with some of that chronological seeding, because it's kind of cool, I think. One of the things that really kind of thrilled me about Sentinel, which in and of itself, again, I wasn't as excited about the characters of Jelf and Ori as I was about the ones in the previous stories, but by the time you get to the end, you're wondering who this Jelf guy was, how's he fit into the grand scheme of things, and to have him be able to reference the Covenant, which referenced the Knights of the Old Republic comics, to reference Revan, which references, of course, the Knights of the Old Republic video games, it gave us that sort of attachment to the outside world that I had thought we weren't going to wind up getting to see in the later stories, because, yeah, the first tales connected back to Golden Age of the Sith, those that era of Tales of the Jedi, but now they're all alone. So how would they know about these things? He provides a nice way of connecting to those things. With the idea being then that the Sith are gone, the Sith are extinct, he's telling her, your side lost. You're the only ones left and you're freaking stranded here. Good luck. At the same time, he had to be very careful of where he was putting that story. The time of rot could have lasted a very long time. The gap between stories could have lasted a very long time. There's a lot of arbitrary angles that could have been taken to the timing, but if he had gone arbitrary, then he could have run into issues with the other Sith. The last stories we get here, the two stories that deal mainly with Varner Hilt saying we are going to rebuild, take place in that gap. And also, so does the previous two, really, although it's really close to the gap, take place in the gap or at the beginning of that gap between what we think of as the end of the old Sith. The Sith Empire has fallen, Revan is doing his thing, and then he's going to fall. At that point, we're not quite up to the point where the Old Republic's Great Galactic War would have happened with the realization that that Sith Empire is able to come back. So yes, to his knowledge, yeah, the Sith are gone. But also, even when we get to the latest point in this story, we're still not to the point where we're at 2,000 years before the films, where we would have wound up with Fannius becoming Darth Ruin and the new Sith emerging. There really is a time in here, at least during the time period of the last two of the ebooks and Pandemonium, that yes, there is a time period where the thought is that the Sith really are gone. Even the ones from the Old Republic video game, the galaxy thinks they are gone. The Lost Tribe is it, only of course no one really seems to know that they exist. I'm very impressed that in the process of trying to set this out with giant jumps in time to give us a very epic feel to the scope of this thing, that it didn't push so far as to start raising questions of, well, what about the new Sith? What about the ones that eventually lead up to Vader and Palpatine? Where do they factor into this thing? He's just shy of that by a little less than 1,000 years by the time this entire story is over with, so it steers perfectly clear and safe of that era and doesn't try to make a connection that didn't need to be made. So often in Star Wars, you'll find writers who try to make a connection that didn't need to be there. Look, it's a story of Han and Chewie. We must have another freaking Kessel Run to be it. Or let's tell yet another version of how Han dumped his spice. Or maybe he's just flying around on another mission, but he's going to reference a way he dumped his spice, but it doesn't quite match what happened the other time. I mean, there's all these different times where in trying to connect things, sometimes it can be great, but if you're not careful with it, it can be a mess. And it could have been a mess to push this too far, and John Jackson Miller wisely doesn't do that. He makes sure we're sticking with, when they say Sith, it's all the ones tying back to the Sith Empire or Tales of the Jedi and the repercussions of that. We're not touching the new Sith at all. Nicely done.
Well, you know, Jelfinori's story, in a sense, is just the death of Grand Lord Ven. I mean, you know, that was like the whole point for the overall book is that. And yet I found Jelf's story what was, for me, the most intriguing about the first two books. You know, he's sitting here at the end of Sentinel. He's at a dilemma. You know, his whole mission here and the whole purpose of his going up into the jungle with the communication device is to warn his people about the Sith. And, you know, they're talking about it. He's like, well, it's pointless now. If the Jedi are divided, or worse, if Revan or someone else has fallen to the dark side, then bringing a planet full of Sith to their attention is the worst thing I could possibly do for the galaxy. And it's like, okay, well, now he's got to kind of tuck tail and hide. It's like, and he goes, I've lived my whole life thinking I knew what I was supposed to do. I just don't know what I'm supposed to do now. And Ori, you know, she's looking at him, and you get her perspective on what it must be like to be a Jedi from her, because, like, you know, when she uses his lightsaber, you know, she's only seen red ones, aside from in the museum, from when some of the original Sith that had crashed had taken some as prizes, this, that, and the other thing. And she watches him, and she notices that he's got this thing about his duty. And she goes, in her mind, it's duty. The term didn't mean the same thing to Sith. In the Sabers, it had missions and had charge to perform. But she had taken them on as personal challenges, not out of some loyalty to a higher order. The galaxy didn't have the right to give her odd jobs. Truly free beings had lives. Slaves had duty. And yet, Jelf is totally torn up that he has to perform some duty. And I love it because she goes, maybe Sith philosophy has the answer for you. What? He says. And she goes, we're taught to be self-centered. we don't think us and them. It's just you versus everyone else. No one else matters. The Sith cast me out. The Jedi cast you out. Maybe neither side deserves our help. The only side we're saving, he said, turning toward her, is ours. Give it a try, Jedi, she said. If I can do something selfless, then maybe it's time for you to do something selfish. And that's where I was really upset, because I really wanted to see where their story was going to continue. I mean, he did a really good job of making me care about those characters, even though, for all intents and purposes, their whole story was just to tell how Grand Lord Venn died and the chaos that would later follow. I did get a kick out of it. I kind of hope to see maybe down the road that there'll be more stories like this. I have to question, when John Jackson Miller set out on this, how much of all of this did he have plotted out? Does he have more of what was going to happen to them figured out, written down in a notepad somewhere? I mean, or was it just something like that was all he planned to tell and that's it?
Kind of makes you wonder, you know, with all the hierarchy and infighting of the Sith, if he was planning out in detail the ascension of all the different Grand Lords and stuff. And if that were the case and it all centered around the death of Grand Lord Lilia Venn, does that make that a Venn diagram? I'm just saying. But I do like the idea with those two that it ends on the kind of the same thing that I was approaching when I was writing Greater Good, the idea that we're so used to this false dichotomy idea. You know, there is one side or the other. Each side thinks they're right, and they're not willing to entertain the view of the other side. But maybe the truth is that somewhere in the middle, there's a third option that you haven't considered simply because you are so dogmatic in your view. In this case, the Jedi and the Sith were so dogmatic in their views that they didn't look at the possibility of just saying, screw it, you know, it's like war games, right? The only way to win is not to play. So they could just essentially sit things out and move forward from there. It could be about their lives, not about the fate of the galaxy constantly resting on every single Jedi or every single Sith's shoulders. And you gotta admit, we assume, presumably, that these two stay together and are together all nice into the future and probably wind up having some descendants who might wind up in the same era of Sith that we wind up seeing with Fate of the Jedi. And you gotta know that Jelf would turn and look at Ori and be like, so we're not gonna be Jedi anymore, in my case? You're not gonna be Sith anymore? We're just gonna be us? Yep. So that whole attachment thing is gone? Yep. All right, let's get busy.
That is something I've always thought about, you know. We've got Mara Jade, Zek. There have been a few that have gone from the dark side to the light, but not many. Vestara Kai. But you see more often Jedi becoming Sith, or in Revan's case, Jedi becoming Sith, becoming Jedi, becoming Sith, becoming something else. And it's that something else that I always want to see. I want to see an order kind of rise up, you know, the gray Jedi, you know, something there. I don't know. It's been played with back and forth. You know, I even question anymore if it's even something that Lucas even wants, but it's something that's in the EU and it's something I want to see played with. So, you know, that's just another one of those schisms within fandom, I guess.
Right. Well, let me put one out there like this. We're going to talk Pandemonium next time. We know that at this point there is a Lost Tribe of the Sith comic series. As of now, when we're recording this, one issue has come out. It takes place pretty much immediately after Pandemonium. And we wind up seeing in the first issue, at the very, very end of the first issue, that somewhere around one of the poles, one of the polar regions, an area that hadn't been explored, that's not Alanciar / Keshta Major, and it's not Keshta / Keshta Minor, it's another area entirely. All of a sudden, here's these people who look like one from Sky. Looks like we got a Chagrian. Looks like we got a Wookiee. It looks like maybe slaves of the Lost Tribe from the ship, or maybe like slaves of the Red Sith, like Naga Sadow, somehow have survived on this planet. For whatever reason, they're there. We don't know where they came from at this point. They might have come with the previous Sith. They might have wound up crashing themselves in some other form somewhere, but they're there. Kind of makes me wonder if he might be able to come back to their story or come back to that family story, and perhaps when they decided to just leave everything behind and live for themselves, maybe in leaving to live for themselves, maybe they came across this other odd third group we've never heard of until Lost Tribe of the Sith Spiral Number 1, and there'll be some kind of tie-in between those two. I doubt it, but I wouldn't put it past John Jackson Miller to have the opportunity to come back and touch on the Ori / Jelf potential future family line at some other point within the story. Be interesting to see if they ever come back. And it would have been interesting to see if Lost Tribe of the Sith, the comic series, would continue after the first arc. But that's something, I guess, from a few episodes ago.
You know, another thing I found interesting was in Pantheon, where, and I think it was from Hilt's point of view, he talks about lords and anti-lords, anti-lords. And I found that concept was kind of interesting, but it was never mentioned again. I was like, what exactly is an anti-lord? Is that like what you become before you become a lord? Is that like the Padawan of the lords?
The terminology things that they bring up here are very interesting. We mentioned it last time how there's, you know, there's a Sith name for things and there's the native name for things and such like that. In this case, we got the anti-lord phrase being just sort of thrown out there as a way of making a comparison between different groups. But I would also say that it's interesting to see how they created factions. You have the Sith a sort of redefining themselves after Lily Aven dies as they lead up in that time of rot to the second of these two books, to books 7 and 8. They're fracturing, and all these different groups sort of take a different little chunk of Sith philosophy or an ancient Sith hero, so to speak, from the era of the first four e-books, and they create their whole way of life around it, the Corsonites, the Sisters of Sela. So in a sense, we're getting a lot of new concepts to how do you make this work. And you would figure that would have to happen. You know, I mean, if the Sith are on a world with a bunch of people who aren't Sith, or the Sith are on a world with Jedi, then the conflict is obvious. You know, the conflict is going to be light side versus dark side, a very rote, run-of-the-mill, that's the way Star Wars works. But when you've got a planet that's essentially with the Sith as the most powerful beings, there's no one there to match them from the standpoint of Jedi or other Force users, and in a sense, all the people of their region of the world, at least until Pandemonium, they are in control of in one form or the other, where's the conflict going to come from? It'll be infighting. And early on, when there was more structure, it was infighting to see who would lead. Now, as things started to break down, that structure's falling apart. The infighting just takes a new shape. It's like the infighting goes from individuals to factions. And in theory, it has the potential to simply be utter chaos, which it essentially is or almost is by the time we get the Testament Day, when Varner Hiltz finally reveals the Testament and brings the people together once they realize that they're slaves. But it's interesting to again see that there's this sort of natural progression into chaos that in this case made a lot of sense, and at the same time gave us some very interesting new factions. I would not be adverse to seeing a new short story or seeing, you know, maybe a flashback in Spiral or something that would perhaps go back and show some of the other conflicts between these different Sith groups. Because by the time we see them, it's the very end of their, you know, faction conflict because they're about to be brought back together by Hiltz. But they had plenty of time to have a lot of interesting clashes and interesting developments and schisms of their own in the process. It's not essential to the story, but it'd be kind of cool to see if they were ever to revisit this time period and they could do it without really having the chance of altering much else in continuity. It's a safe era because all there is these stories to build from. They don't have to worry about other stuff around it. It's a fertile landscape.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's so many different factions. We also have the Golden Destiny, Force 57, which I believe those were like the outcast group that slowly, like, they almost seem like mutant-like. You know, one thing, though, that has struck me was the lignum crystals. You know, we see later that they were used to kind of do like what the Carillions would do with their little graveyards where they would put the crystals up in the wall. They used the lignum crystals to put up like kind of star charts and calligraphy up on the ceilings. And then Hiltz, you know, I liked Hiltz. He was kind of a funny character in and of a sense. He was almost like the people person, you know. Like, he saw the Sith for what they really were. He saw through it all because he was the historian. He even was lousy with a lightsaber. Like, you know, they mentioned, like, don't stand next to him, you could get amputated. But he pulls out a triangular recording device, and I immediately thought Sith Holocron. I don't know about you, Nathan, but everything about that was screaming Sith Holocron to me. The whole lignum crystal thing, though, I go back to Darktide especially because it didn't seem like in Cross Current what we saw in Darktide with them was what was going on. In Cross Current, they were just there, just like they are in here. In Riptide, it was like they were causing something to happen to Force users, and it was almost pushing them towards the dark side. You know, and we don't see that. And you know, we'd mentioned this before in post show, and it got cut because we didn't have enough time, but my theory still, I still think that the hyperspace jump had to have done something different to the crystals, and that was why they were so much more significantly unstable in a dark side sense in Riptide. Because that never really fit right to me, that there was no consequence about being around all the lignum crystals. And when Secrets gets up to where Omen is crashed, and they start looking through things and finding things, and Hiltz has progressively found like one new thing after one new thing after one new thing, and because he's the historian, he's able to connect the dots and put it out there for everyone. The way it all fell together was really cool. It felt very well done. It was like the last piece on a puzzle when it falls in, when Hiltz himself realizes that they, the warring factions, have destroyed his library, and now he is the living relic. He has the answers that will save them all. In a sense, they have forced him to take a job he does not want to take. What's more, he follows Yaru Corson's original ruling and takes a wife, and takes Aiella, or Ilion. And I love that, because like the way that that plays out, I really thought that was a clever thing all the way around. And the way it works out in Hilt's mind about how if she wants to live long, she's going to keep him alive. And that made sense. It's like, what a perfect bodyguard for a Sith. Marry someone who is even stronger than you and have a rule where she will die if you die. I'm like, what a perfect way to have some slave labor / bodyguard, man.
Well, you know, you got to have a strong woman around. That's why my fiance is a former Georgia Golden Gloves boxer and stuff. Because, you know, if something happens, you know, she can just beat the living hell out of him. Things that stand out to me, though, from that, one thing that jumps out at me is just from the standpoints of Hiltz, he's an interesting figure to be the new leader of the Sith, and it's kind of cool the way he winds up with Ilyana at his side. He's not the normal Sith, though, in most respects, in his attitude. And this plays out not just in the span of these two stories, but, I mean, push it forward into Pandemonium, push it forward into Spiral. He just doesn't have the Sith attitude in most respects. He's much more like, you know, we must go out and kill them. Yeah, whatever, you know, you have at that. You have fun, you know, little Sith boy. He's not someone who is very tied up in the idea of conflict and conquering so much as the other Sith are, which means that he may be the person who has this repository of knowledge that can help bring the Sith back to who they are, but I gotta wonder how long his reign can really last and what can happen after him, because it's almost like he is, while bringing them back to who they are in knowledge, his leadership in and of itself is like watering down Sith philosophy. He is no Yaru Corson. I would say he's much more like Luke than he is like Yaru Corson or any of the other early era Sith. He's much more for, you know, do whatever, and when it's necessary, yeah, we'll go in there and fight. Of course, in their case, it's when it's necessary to get power or something like that as opposed to protecting others. But it's certainly not the kind of aggressiveness that I would expect from a Sith leader. Maybe with Ilyana at his side, her maybe pushing it, but from what I'm seeing throughout, again, throughout the rest of this book and throughout Spiral, it doesn't seem as though Ilyana has that sort of browbeating, you know what, we need to conquer, they're going to look at you as weak, you better go out there and do it. You know, she's not forcing him into acts of extreme violence for the sake of appearances. She's kind of letting him be him, as he used to say on a West Wing, let Bartlett be Bartlett. Well, she's letting Hiltz be Hiltz. Well, that's lovely and all, except how do you get from his leadership, which has that level of moderation, so to speak, to it, to the way we see the Lost Tribe of the Sith when we see them in some of the first flashbacks and stuff within the life of Estar Akai in the Fate of the Jedi era? Yes, there is 3,000 plus years in between, but obviously, his way of looking at things must be supplanted at some point, supplemented at some point, twisted at some point, to get it back a little bit more to the more aggressive Sith roots. And it would be interesting to see something in that time span in which the Lost Tribe is not just lost, but also not covered in any Star Wars published stories yet.
You know, another thing that I liked was the coincidences. You know, you read Star Wars books and it's always the hand of the Force, you know. Oh, all these coincidences. Luke happens to go to the same planet that Leia's on. And, oh, hey, here comes Han with the army that they need at just the right time. And we have Testament Day. And we also have Nita's Rise. And this is the first year that the two are going to pretty much coincide. And then on top of it, Hilt's little apprentice, the Kishiri apprentice, was it Jay? discovers that there is a time thing off. And so it's like when the entire faction and stuff's about to blow up because they're showing up for Testament Day. This is like the one time where everybody shows up and everybody gets along because they all want to hear what the recording of Yaru Corson has to say. And they all show up early because Sela wants to adjust what it says because – or not Sela, but Elana wants to change it because – Sela was the founder of the tribe. That's how she saw it. You know, she was the one that really they should be worshiping her, not condemning her. And so she wants to have it changed. Well, everyone else sees that their group is in, and so it kind of all comes to a head 8 days early. And this is perfect time for Jay to point out, because Jay's just this awesome mathematician now that the Sith have taught the Kesh how to use math. And he's able to tell them, hey, you know, our sands work a little differently from up off the mountain down here. We're actually 8 days ahead of schedule here, and we should be doing it now. So they play the message. And when the message gets done playing, we find a second message that was from Naga Shado to Yaru Corson. And one of the things I loved was, like, not even before this message started, Neera of Force 57 was going on about Ravelin, Roth, and how there's no pictures of him, and their side of the culture needs to be represented more. And when they see Naga Sado, and he's talking, she goes, "What is that thing?" You know, I was like, and it talks about how the image changed. It was the visage of Naga Sado, and it startled the viewers, the appearance of the one called Ravelin and his escorts evoked audible gasps, his skin fully crimson. And we start seeing how it changes the way that they perceive themselves. And it changes you as a reader, the way you look at the Sith culture. Because, you know, the Sith, Naga Sado and all them, came from the group that were interbred with dark Jedi. So you had human Jedi at one point come and they interbreed with the Sith. They change everything up, and they become what is the Red Sith that these humans from Tempai are kind of rebelling against, too. And it's interesting how the Sith themselves, the Red Sith themselves, had these visions of the humans taking over. The humans had these visions of them taking over. And all this stuff happens at the same time. I love those little, you know, coincidences when they work out well. And the whole fact that because of what they learned about how they were slaves to that thing, you know, it wasn't just that they were slaves, but to that thing. Oh my gosh. I just loved it. It threw them in complete chaos. I mean, they were ready to just kill themselves. They show up to where Omen is. They're going to destroy everything. At this point, we're in secrets, and Hiltz is up there trying to find the last little bit because at the end of the message, Yaru tells Nida the true power is hidden behind the throne. And Hiltz discovers, hey, that's like an Indiana Jones reference. We gotta look behind the throne. And the throne isn't here, it's up there. And the way it all played out, I was really enjoying it. Like I said, man, I kept feeling like it was Indiana Jones, National Treasure. It was a definite treasure hunt. And by the time it was all done, it worked out in Hiltz's favor.
Yep, and of course the secret behind the throne is, hey, look, maps. There's a whole nother continent, which is exactly where we wind up for the ninth book in this series, the last book in, or the last story in the collected stories, and the story that, as it ends, will launch off Spiral. I guess to wrap us up here, you mentioned coincidences. We are now through Precipice Skyborn, Paragon Savior, Purgatory Sentinel, Pantheon Secrets. Up in our next episode of Star Wars Beyond the Films will be Pandemonium. And, of course, you can be sure to follow the continuing adventures of the Lost Tribe of the Sith in the story Spiral. In other words, we are through P.S., 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 P.S. We're about to hit P, and you can follow it in S. Interesting coincidences there. I wonder if there's much meaning behind it.
I never caught that. That's funny. Oh, nice. Nice. Well, remember, you can listen to our show airing on Middle Earth Network Radio, as well as streaming on the Star Wars Report website, www.starwarsreport.com. Our episodes are also available right on our Facebook page at SW Beyond Films, or just type in Star Wars Beyond the Films in the search bar. No matter how you get there, though, be sure to like our page. That's right, we've got the contest. It's just about to wrap up as Celebration 6 kicks off. The issue I have sitting up here of hardcover of Fatal Alliance is going out to one lucky winner. Anybody who likes it before that first day, you're also available to be part of that drawing. So get out there, like our page. It's the best way to interact with us. Not only can you post comments to let us know that you're listening to our show, you can also interact with us. You can actually email us, too. We have feedback episodes. We release those each month if we get enough of them. If you have something to say, fire it off. You can email us at swbeyondfilms@starwarsfanworks.com. You can also use our old one. I'm not going to mention it just because it might confuse you, but go ahead and do either one, whichever one works, as long as we get the email. And then also, you know, who sponsors this show? Well, you could. That's right. We're always looking for sponsorships. So if you want to, get us out there. Hit us with the email as well. You know, we'd be more than happy to take on a sponsor or two. You know, once again, this has been Mark Herleman and Whistler.
And Nathan.
Whistler, knock it off. Saying thank you for listening, and may the Force be with you.
And don't quote us the odds that the next story is going to be starting with a P, and the one after it'll start with an S, and then a P, and an S, and a P, and an S, and a P.